Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Today's guest is Mr. Dan Plews, Dr. Dan Plews, in fact, a revered Yorkshireman. I should introduce that first, although he has transplanted himself into Auckland, where he's a researcher at the Auckland University there. He also coaches pro athletes in the sports of triathlon and time trial cycling. He is a physiologist with New Zealand female kayaking team and also a very, very competent iron distance triathlete. Tell us about your last performance, Dan, which was only a few weeks ago, I understand.
Well, firstly, thanks for having me back on, Simon. I think it's been, can't believe you said before that it's been 2 years already since I was last on here.
Well, it has been 2 years, but we're a bit delayed getting that podcast out. So for the listeners, it'll seem like it was only a few months ago.
Right, okay. Well, to me, it seems like a long time ago. So I'm in New Zealand early March. I did that. So yeah, did 8:35. So I'm on PB. Can't complain.
And that's you all set for Kona then, I guess.
Yeah, ticket stamped, as they say. So, I'll be going to, that's my second time in Kona. So first time is always a bit of a looking mission. And I think no matter how many times people prepare you for how brutal it is, I don't think anything can actually prepare you truly in your mind. So hopefully this time I'm going back with a little bit more realization.
Yeah, of exactly what you let yourself in for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. I've got 6 months to prepare for it in my head.
Yes, but it'll go just like that, won't it? We know that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for coming back on the show, Dan. Last time we talked, and listeners, if you go right back to one of the very first episodes we published, I will put the link at the end of this podcast. Dan and his business partner, Professor Paul Larson, we were discussing heart rate variability back then and just going through some of the introductory information you need to know. But I've been posting a little bit about HRV and recovery recently because I think these two things are really overlooked by not just triathletes, but many endurance athletes and indeed just often normal gym goers. Dan, you might have a view on this, that people seem to think that as long as they're training really hard, that's all that matters in terms of getting fitter and healthier. But it's a sum, an equation which has two parts, X plus Y, with the Y being rest. And if X is 1 and Y 0, then the sum's 0. So we know that we've got to have rest in there to make the training all worthwhile, correct?
Correct, yeah. And I think we had the conversation just before, is that I think some, you know, there's always going to be some level of damage. And so if you're really wanting to improve and train quite hard, you're obviously going to be, you have to stress the body, but the important thing is that you're looking at the other side of that equation as well.
Yeah, so is heart rate, I think actually last time we said that heart rate variability is not a silver bullet. If you're looking for something to enhance your fitness and enhance your recovery, is HRV really the answer, or is just listening to your body and using good old-fashioned common sense a good start point?
Well, I think, you know, I would always say that common sense is, you know, that's first and foremost. Like you intuitively know your body better than anyone. But having said that, lots of people are also not very good at listening to their own body. I mean, dare I say that not lots of people don't have common sense. But
you can say that, yeah, because you're a Yorkshireman and people know that they say
exactly,
how it is.
Yeah, you've got to say how it is, but as a result of that, I don't think you can rely solely on that. And equally as you can't rely solely on a objective measure like HRV, it's always this more holistic approach that you've got to take. And HRV can be one thing that you're going to do in the morning that's going to give you a very easy, quick snapshot of how you're feeling compared to, you know, and give you and kind of, it's more, it gives you a bit more certainty in the decision you're making. So you might wake up one morning, you know, you're really grumpy, you've had a bad night's sleep, you're not feeling that great, and then your HRV kind of confirms it. Then you're like, oh, okay, maybe I should readjust my training today, or shall I think about how I'm going to reschedule this week, or what shall I do in terms of recovery and things like that.
So what, because this is one of the objections that I've been hearing, is that we have a mindful athlete who's decided to actually use one of the HRV apps out there. I know that you have a connection with HRV for training, but there are other apps that can be used. And they take their measurement in the morning, and it suggests that perhaps it will be better for them to take either an easy day or have a day of rest rather than training, just because of the various stresses that the body's under. But the plan says that they need to do a big ride that day followed by a run off the bike. You must have seen this as a coach, Dan. You may even have experienced it as an athlete. So how does an athlete approach that particular issue on that morning?
One of the things that, I mean, lots of the research that I've done with some of my papers is that we know how things affect HRV, and we know what makes people tired, we know what stresses the body. If that was me and I had an athlete, I wouldn't adjust the volume so much. I would go around adjusting the intensity, because we know that serious reductions in HRV, where the real stress response, and you think about increases in heart rate, are really associated with kind of those circulating, what we call catecholamines and noradrenaline. That's the thing that, you know, that ruins your endocrine system, and it's also the thing that really pushes down the HRV. So you've got to know in what context of what you're doing, how the training is going to affect it. So if it's me as one of my athletes and I saw that HRV was really low, if it was a long aerobic easy day, I'd be like, okay, that's fine. Just don't get too caught up with your mates going up a hill. But if it was something that was like a real high intensity day, I would then think twice about what I was going to do, and I'd probably shift it to a lower intensity day.
You talked about the endocrine system there. So that's sort of when we're getting cortisol and adrenaline shunted around the system, and the whole rest and digest, fight or flight system, and the balance between, or sympathetic and parasympathetic, as you might call them. And it's the balance between that. And the more hard work you do and the more high intensity you do, the more is it parasympathetics, the fight or flight? Is that right?
Sympathetic is a fight or flight. Yeah. And that's just, yeah. I mean, that's one thing that, you know, all the sympathetic system can have marked effects on that for sure. But, you know, and anything that you're doing in terms of training, you know, affects the endocrine system. You know, so one of the things that really goes, when people are training really hard, one of the things that's really affected is people's libido, right? And that's just a classic endocrine system response to training hard. And it's the same with the HRV and the sympathetic side. So all these factors can have a really pivotal role in how you're feeling. But most of that is to do, especially on the sympathetic side, is to do with the intensity of training, not necessarily the duration, especially when you're talking about age group athletes, because age group athletes are hard pressed on time. And so they're really hard pressed to achieve massive stress based purely on training volume. Pro guys can do it easily, you know, when they're doing 30, 40-hour training weeks. But I don't think you see that as often in age group athletes.
So high-intensity training is fine, because actually somebody posted a response to this comment on a Facebook page this morning. You know, you had to train fast to get better. And we probably both know that that's right, but you have to limit the amount of hard training you do to get better. Otherwise, you just get more tired, based on what you've just said.
Yeah, I mean, when the comment of you have to train fast to get better, well, you have to train slow to get better too.
Very good. Very good.
You know? So, I mean, it's not one or the other. It's a combination of both. And I think you'd be way better off spending more time training slow than training fast. So, but yeah, it's definitely a combination of the two.
Now, my understanding is that when we up the training, heart rate variability, the immediate or the in the short term, your heart rate variability results are going to go down. Is that right? Because that's what you'd expect if you were putting the body under strain.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, it depends on the type of training. If you like for the sports that we're more concerned with, which is, you know, Ironman triathlon or triathlon, which is more of an endurance based sport, assuming that most then of the training is at a low intensity, especially if you were following that kind of polarized pyramidal model,
yes,
then it will actually, if you're training effectively, it'll start to rise, it will go up, and then when you go into recovery week, it should come back down towards baseline levels, particularly if you're already been doing quite a lot of training and you're already quite fit, but you're just, so what you see is the HRV changes in response to load more than in response to fitness. So what I mean by that is that if you have someone who's really unfit and they start a training program, the HRV will go up and up and up, and then it will stay up for a prolonged, it'll stay up pretty much as long as they're healthy and fitter. But in an athlete who's already fit, that fitness isn't going to increase by enough to, for it to go up and for the HRV to go up and then stay up. But what we do see is the HRV goes up and comes back down in responses to training load. So typically, like before my Ironman New Zealand, the way when I'm doing a big training block, for example, I'll be looking at my HRV to make sure it is going up. And during that training load, I want to see it rising above normal baseline values. And then when I taper, I want to see it come back down towards where it was before. And that's pretty intuitive and pretty normal. And most people will know that when they're in a high training load, it's really hard to get the heart rate up sometimes, or the rate of rise in heart rate is quite slow. And that's because you're a bit more parasympathetic dominant. But then when you taper, suddenly your heart rate's come back to normal. But you also got a higher cardiac output because the resting heart rate, the maximum heart rate's set back up again. So
okay, now, but if we were using one of the commercially available apps, they don't give you the raw data. They give you a figure based on the other data they've collected. So that's sort of giving you a score out of 8. Or if you use the Elite HRV, it's like a little rev counter, isn't it, that sort of, if the arrow's in the middle, it's green, but if it's one side, it's showing more sympathetic action, and if it's on the other side, it's more parasympathetic, but it's tendency towards orange or red. So would you necessarily notice that it's going up there, or would you just see that it would be just more indicating whether you should be resting, recovering, or able to train hard and take on more load?
Yeah, well, this is where, like, if you look at lots of my PhD work, I kind of do state a lot that I think on a given day, like, using HRV in isolation is not that great. I mean, I've always been under the idea that rolling averages and averages are a lot better, which is why that for my athletes, I use the HRV for training coach app. Right. And I use the HRV for training app to collect the data. So the HRV for training app is awesome for collecting the data. And it does give me and then when it comes through to me, I will have, what it does is I'll have it on a screen and I have three scores, and I'll see HRV, and that'll be red, green, or amber. I'll see a subjective score, that'll be red, green, or amber. Then that'll be a daily score, which is the combination, like taking into account the subjective and the HRV together, which gives me kind of an overall score. So if I'm looking at that and I see red subjective, red HRV, red daily, then I'll be like, okay, that's enough for me to kind of have a look at the training and maybe even flip them a quick message and see how they're doing. But if I just had like an amber on the HRV or a red on the HRV and a green on the subjective, I wouldn't be so fast to make contact. You know, I'd be looking, I'm wanting all those things to fly up red. But having said that, then if I go into the actual coach app and I'm looking at the trends, and by the time I'm looking at that, I've seen this is day three and it's really, and looking at the averages, it's really dropped down quite far. And then I'll be much more confident in that value and something's probably not right in this individual.
Right, okay. So the coach app, that's the one I'm thinking of getting to use with athletes. So they would get the HRV for training app on their phone, do that little fingerprint test every morning with the camera, get the results, and then it gets sucked into the coach app as well. And that's the one I look at, and that's the one you use to look at the general trends. And so if what you're saying there, then, if we go back and I've understood it right, is if things are going right and they're training, you should see a general upward trend. But if you see start to see a downward trend, then it either means that they're getting the intensity or the volume of the training wrong, or there's an external stress that's adding to all of their lack of recovery. Yeah. Would that be right? So that might.
That can be.
What would those external stresses be then? Which ones have the biggest effect on a downward trend in HRV?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And I always like to call them the three pillars of recovery. So for me, the three major factors of recovery, and then you've got all your little fancy thrills on the side, are sleep, nutrition, and training periodization. So where are you putting all the training sessions within a training week to make sure that they recover and they are ready for the next session? So, and I would say that I wouldn't put them in any particular order of importance, but like sleep's obviously absolute key. I mean, I've just read a book by a guy called Darren Walker called The Science of Sleep. And I mean, I recommend anyone to read that book because it'll make you really stand up and pay close attention to how seriously we take sleep. And I don't think we, especially athletes, we really take sleep very seriously at all. And that, you know, again, making sure you get the quality 8 hours and sleep hygiene and all those sorts of things is just so important. And I always tell the athletes I work with, I'm like, you know, if you were going to do a high intensity interval training session on the track, you wouldn't just rock up and do it. You'd prepare for it. You'd do a warm up. You do your, you know, you do all the correct procedures. And I believe that's how you should almost prepare for sleep every night. And that's something that I've definitely changed in my lifestyle. Bearing in mind, I've also got a 6-month-old little girl, which she does ruin my sleep sometimes.
Poor little thing. Yeah. Well, and now publicly she's been cast as the enemy.
She's awesome.
But you make an interesting point there, Dan. I always think that if you were to draw a circle and divide it into three, with each of those three items you just mentioned there, sleep, nutrition and training periodization, ideally each one of those would occupy 1/3 in terms of the attention we should give them if we wanted the maximum benefit from the training effort we put in. Each of those should occupy 1/3 of our attention in terms of planning for sleep and rest and planning our food and planning our meal times and, you know, periodizing our nutrition, if you like.
But it's also amazing how the three are interconnected as well. Like, you know, you do a training session too late at night, it impacts on your sleep. You do a training session late at night, you eat too late, that impacts on your sleep. So there's, you know, the two, everything connects. I have this ring called an Aura ring
that,
and it monitors all my sleep stuff. And I just find it fascinating with the way I'll toss and turn so much more if I've been on my computer too late, or how my resting heart rate comes so much later in the day when I've had a meal a lot later. Sorry, my resting heart rate's a lot later in my night's sleep. If I had a meal a lot later in that evening, and you know, this is fascinating, and it's really helped me at least know the cues and the signs and the things that I have to do to try and give myself the best chance of having a good sleep.
Well, I use a similar product called the Whoop, which is a wrist strap,
I think it's Whoop, Simon. You know, it's an American product. Let's get it right. Come on.
Yeah, but I'm in Yorkshire. So it's a Whoop. But anyway, I think we're talking about the same thing, buddy. The fascinating thing for me there is that when you talk to people about sleep and they'll say, yes, I get 8 hours sleep every night. I go to bed at 10 and I get up at 6. You can guarantee that there's at least an hour of time when they're awake there. Every time they turn over, there's 2 or 3 minutes lost. I don't think I've ever been in bed for 8 hours and had exactly 8 hours sleep. It normally amounts to... No. If it's a good night, there'll be 40 to 50 minutes of awake time in there. Sometimes you don't notice that. There'll be, you can tell when you're having your deep sleep. You can see that the deep sleep, for me anyway, comes early in the night and the light sleep comes later. But like you, if I have a glass of wine early in the evening, my sleep is better. I get off to sleep quicker. If I have a glass of wine later on in the evening, my sleep's more disrupted. If I have 2 or 3 glasses of wine, it affects my HRV. And the point I was coming back to about those three legs of the stool that you were talking about is that the pie chart ideally would be 1/3 of each, but in most people's attention, training occupies 90% of their attention. As a coach, they'll come to you and ask, what can I do? What more training can I do to get faster? How many more sessions can I do? Can I try this? Can I try that? They'll think of nutrition maybe on the day when they're going to have some food and think maybe they need to have this and have that. But most people don't plan out what they're going to eat or plan it in times with the training.
And they mostly think of it wrong because they're just they've got poor nutritional advice.
Yes, they've got nutritional what?
Poor nutritional advice, mostly.
Oh, yes. And sleep. Most people don't even think about sleep. They just sleep just happens upon them when they feel tired, but they don't consider how to prepare for a good night's sleep. They might have spent more money kitting out their gym and buying a new bike than they would ever dream on spending on a mattress where they ideally would spend a third of their life. In fact, the response, you know, if you ask people how much they spent on a mattress, they'd say, oh, a couple of hundred quid. But they'd happily spend $5,000 on a bike.
Well,
to me and you, it should be the other way around. Spend $5,000 on your mattress and spend 200 quid on your bike because that will get you better results.
Yeah.
Okay. So lots of things can affect HRV, particularly nutrition. Travel. Do you see travel, long-haul travel affecting that?
Oh, yeah. I remember when I've done travel, the day after a long-haul flight, it can be the same as the day after an Ironman in me. I've actually seen that number. So, yeah, but that's where the HRV can be so beneficial because it gives you an instant indicator of where you were before, after travel. And then at least you can kind of, you know, you've got a marker of where you know you want to get back to before you start hard training again. So, say, like, me and I'm going to go in on a training camp soon, and when I travel over there, I'm going to use my HRV to give me an indicator of when I've adapted to the heat and also adapted to the long haul travel. So I won't really start kicking in any real high intensity. I'll just keep it low intensity aerobic training until it's actually returned to the same kind of values that it was prior to the travel.
It was interesting for me wearing this bracelet, how my HRV was when I had the flu at Christmas, because I had 2 weeks when I really didn't feel like doing anything. I was just confined to the house, even walking up the stairs was a strain, and my scores were really very poor. Mm. Then I came out to that time when I was sort of, you know, demonstrating some displaying symptoms of the flu. And I, obviously, having been cooped up for 2 weeks, I felt like I really wanted to do some activity. And as we know, a lot of people would at that point think, well, I should get, you know, they're getting a bit angsty because they haven't done any training. So they'd be back on the training. But my HRV was so poor then, I left it at least another week before I actually did anything other than going for a walk out in the fresh air. And I'm sure that helped me to actually get back a bit quicker. At the same time, I've heard a few people say, well, I thought I was better, so I started to do some training, and then a week later they got ill again because clearly their immune system just wasn't strong enough to support daily stresses and activity as well, and they were just a bit vulnerable to other germs. So I found it really, really interesting to track that as I was getting over the flu, and it really didn't get back to normal for about 4 or 5 weeks. So I had to be very careful with what training I introduced.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just another great example of, you know, the thing I said in the last podcast, you can't manage what you don't measure. And, you know, having that and the cost benefit of HRV is just so good now. Like, you can download the apps, you can do it in a minute, you don't have to wear a heart rate monitor. The actual cost of doing it is almost nothing, but the potential reward is really great. So, people should definitely include it, regardless of whether they're training or not training. I think it's quite a useful marker just for general health.
Yeah, well, I think we did talk before about the fact that, you know, for the majority of people, triathlon's a hobby. Maybe even for you, it's a hobby, although you're just very good at it. But that health and longevity have to be priorities. Certainly for me, and as I've got older, it's become more of a priority than when I thought that I could just, you know, everything would bounce off me and I was indestructible when I was in my early 30s. But what you're saying there is it's HRV, it's a low cost in terms of energy, in terms of effort required to take the data, and yet the data it gives you about your health and longevity is invaluable, really. And for some people, it might even pinpoint something that's going to be quite debilitating coming up, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and I mentioned before, like, I'm actually currently writing a review with a cardiologist from Stanford University. And there's a cardiologist who's really interested in HRV from that all-cause mortality, general health aspect. So it's, you know, it's, they got the best people in the world who are looking at HRV as a marker and as an indicator of basic wellness, right? So I remember that me and Prof, we were once asked it was a prize that came up with the way to improve people's lifespans or methods that you could use if anyone's got any ideas. And the marker and the marker that they were using to suggest people's health and increases in longevity was improvements in HRV. So it's, you know, like it's a known fact that people who have higher HRV, and you know, that's influenced through diet, exercise, low stress, sleep, you know, generally living a healthy lifestyle, will have healthier lives.
Well, and I guess I'm just about to participate in a cardiac study, heart study with Professor Sanjay Sharma, who you might know in London. But this is about extreme endurance, which is really what we do in older men, over 40, between 40 and 60. There's been a lot of press releases.
I don't make that cut.
Yeah, you will do soon. But by then we'll have all contributed to the research.
On the HRV, I hopefully will.
Yeah, we'll have already contributed to the research which keeps you healthy in later life, Dan. But there was a book out called The Haywire Heart, which documented some of the extreme endurance athletes that we probably both know who've had heart issues. I mean, Dave Scott, Greg Welsh, Norman Stadler are three elite triathletes, very prominent elite triathletes that have had heart issues. And they're trying to find out where there's a correlation between doing long-term extreme endurance exercise and later development of heart issues. But I guess as triathletes, we all feel like we're indestructible, that we do this sport of Ironman that requires supreme levels of discipline, of concentration, and physical fitness. And it must come as a surprise to us when we hear that there's actually an increased possibility of heart problems. So again, using something like HRV regularly, even if we wanted to ignore it, might actually be telling us that we're heading down the wrong route and into a heart related problem. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yeah, I mean, if you're like people, you will have some changes in that HRV. I mean, it's quite an interesting, like, this it's kind of an area that really fascinates me is this kind of athlete health conundrum. And Phil Maftan, they wrote that really great paper on athletes, are they really fit, fit and healthy, fit but unhealthy, I think was the title. And basically they're saying, you know, just because you're fit doesn't mean you're healthy. And that's, I mean, I work with a lot of elite athletes, and during my time at rowing, I was like, some of them were just appallingly unhealthy, and you can just see it in the way they eat and the way they look after themselves. And part of that, I do believe, if you want it, especially at the higher elite level, is almost unavoidable. I do believe that there is some level of risk that you have to push your body to such extreme, such level of stresses, that it's not going to be the best for you. But having said that, there's so many things that you can do to mitigate any of those potential threats that you're opposing on yourself. So HRV being one of them, taking hold, you know, taking advantage of what's available and controlling your own destiny and actually monitoring what's going on. It's just something that can be done to help with that.
Yeah, it's something I'm interested in as well. You know, seeing athletes that are constantly battling little sore throats or tickly coughs, but convincing themselves that they need to train hard and that being exhausted all the time and tired and having aching muscles is part of what they're trying to do. And they never seem to have any enjoyment out of what they do. And they always seem to be battling to recover from something. And I know that some people talk about, you know, stress and injury as well. You know, the amount of, not just the amount of training you do, but just the fact that your body's out of sorts can leave you more prone to injury, tendon issues
There is also some, there's a bit of data that's now suggested. There's a paper that came out the other day that was relating injury and low HRV. So when HRV was low, the risk of injury, the chances of getting injured was higher. I can't remember the paper, but I think it was in some collegiate sports.
And what was the reason for that then?
Well, whether it's, that's the thing. So I mean, my take on it was, well, maybe what, you know, is the HRV predicting their injury, or is the HRV low because they're under high training loads and therefore they're getting injured? You know what I mean? So, yeah. You know, the HRV might be was more likely down because they've got a high training load. So the HRV goes down, the training load is too high for them to handle, and therefore they get injured.
I remember in the last conversation that you and I and Paul had, Paul made a reference to HRV being an indicator of what's happening with the central nervous system.
Mm.
And I guess if you're training hard, there will be central nervous system fatigue as well. And I've experienced myself when I've, you know, done a lot of running or when I've done a long race that I feel a bit clumsy sometimes. You know, if I'm doing, I remember doing one run and just trying to pick up my cadence and be a bit more precise with my foot plant. And it just didn't seem, no matter how much I tried and thought about it, it just didn't seem to happen. The next 2 days later, when I went out and ran, it was easy. And it was almost like I'd recovered and I was fresher, but it was my central nervous system. It wasn't aerobic fatigue. It was sort of like, you know, coordination fatigue. And I guess if you're training hard, then your central nervous system is a bit tired. And maybe then you're a bit less precise with how you carry out movements, and that could lead to injury. I guess if your running gait changes, or if your stride length changes, or if you just the way you're reacting to things is a bit slower.
Yeah, and that's the thing about HRV is very global, so that's one of the good things about it is, you know, because it is related to your central nervous system, and that's just about related to every single movement in the body. So. I mean, the link between injury and HRV is plausible, but it's not proven. So there was an author called Giselman who wrote a paper, and she's based out of Otago in New Zealand, who was basically the hypothesis. She hypothesized this, and you know, the link between HRV and an injury, and you know, she gave some very sound physiological reasons as to why there is likely a link, but yeah, it's still yet to be proven. But I am doing a bit of work with Marco Altini. Well, hopefully in the future, we're not yet, but he has talked about it. Marco Altini from HRV for Training, looking at some of the data that he collects in from the app. And because within some of that, you have to link, you can put whether you're injured or not. So we're going to try and have a look at that and see if there is actually anything going on there.
Interesting. Just before you go, Dan, I did mean to ask you about that blog post you published a couple of weeks ago after Ironman New Zealand, where you talked about, and you mentioned it just briefly earlier on, about polarized versus pyramidal training intensity distribution, and how that changes, or how you think that should change as you get closer to a race. Can you just expand on that a little, and maybe it's a subject we could tee up now and do in another call later on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we can certainly. Well, maybe, yeah, maybe the whole subject's quite long, so maybe it's an area for another chat. But basically, so I mean, I know there's people talk about polarized training all the time. People get really, you know, they get really obsessed with polarized training. But like in my, I'm just thinking that, you know, that polarized training model is based on kind of what we call those mystery zone sports in the Olympics. So that'd be 6 minutes rowing and 4,000 pursuit, and where the actual intensity of exercise is way, way above or generally above VO2 max intensity. So quite a high intensity. So that means that principle of specificity in training, we need to have that time at level five, because, you know, level five or VO2 sort of type of area, because that's where the exercise takes place. Conversely, when you look at Ironman, it's nowhere near that sort of intensity.
Mm.
And it's more like, you know, just above the first lactate threshold, or just below the second for
you,
Ironman.
For you, maybe, Dan, for you.
Sorry, I'm just always talking what I think of in elite terms.
Yeah.
Or just below like the second lactate threshold in a half Ironman. And that means that you have a whole heap of time spent in kind of that mid zone between the first and the second thresholds.
Mm.
So if you're following any kind of principle of specificity, which is obviously a key indicator of, you know, a key requirement and consideration for sport, then it's impossible to spend not a lot of time within that, between those two zones.
Okay, but obviously the polarized model that primary endurance people are following is that if you're training between those zones too much, then that does create a lot more fatigue. Their theory is it doesn't actually create that much more fitness, and that you'd be better off exercising slightly lower, maybe below that first turn point. So in a much easier aerobic zone, so non-glycolytic, I suppose. And
yeah, but it's not, that's not the sport that we do. Like, why do we get tired when we do an Ironman? Like, it's because we've got a constant, I always think about kind of the, because I'm more involved in the pros and the top end age groupers, but like the thing that's limiting them, it's not, I mean, that most of them can go and ride 180K easy, you know, no worries. But the problem lies when they're trying to apply pressure for 180K, they're trying to ride a wattage that's not hard, but it's, you know, it's in that somewhat hard range. And that's what makes their legs, that's what makes them tired for the run, and that's what they can't handle. So if you're not spending time doing that specifically, training the VO2 and then doing really easy stuff is not specific enough. So I totally agree that most of the time should still be below the first threshold, but you still should have, you know, it shouldn't, not that 80-20 rule should shift to more like 60-40.
What you're saying is that should shift in that specific period. So 15 weeks before the race, you shift more into that middle zone. But throughout the rest of the year, you can stay pretty fit and probably healthier by not going into that sort of sweet spot training quite as much.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a shift from, you know, as you know, like me now, I'm way more polarized. In fact, I'm probably not even polarized, to be honest with you. I'm just easy.
Yeah.
I'm just all kind of level two. But, you know, I will increase a little bit of high intensity soon. But then as I get into the racing, I'll become more pyramidal in my training distribution. And it's, you know, and it comes back to also this idea of specificity and, you know, the idea of reverse periodization is that, like, you always start with the things that are probably least specific. So speed work for a triathlete is not a specific, it's not specific for the event. So you would be better doing that earlier in the season and doing it first and then moving into more of the Ironman paced longer reps. Mm. In my opinion, at least. I mean, I just think people make the mistake mostly is that they do their intervals too short and too hard. And you, with that kind of mentality and approach, you reach a ceiling really fast and you don't improve as quick.
Right. Yes. When I read your little blog piece, it seemed to mirror, I was quite pleased actually, because it seemed to mirror what I'd instinctively thought is that for me during the winter, build that low end base, stay healthy. People seem to just stay healthy if they stay away from doing too much of that sweet spot training all the time. Particularly around in Yorkshire, you probably end up in that sweet spot zone accidentally when you're riding up hills. So as long as you're doing that sort of riding or running, you don't need to plan it in and have them doing some quite short, hard intervals on a more polarized method. And then as they, when they enter into the 20 weeks, 15 weeks before the race, we move into doing some higher threshold work, and then as they get closer to the race, the sort of intervals get longer and the intensity gets slightly lower. So it's sort of just above race intensity, maybe climbing intensity, and everything, as you say, becomes much more specific to the speeds that they're actually running and riding and swimming in their race, but with a little bit of high intensity.
And that's a really sensible way to do it.
Yeah. And it seems to keep people healthy. And I think that's the thing is, going back to your health and longevity, if you're healthy, so you've got no colds and you've got no injuries, then your training's consistent. And I think we'd all put consistency at the top or very close to the top of factors for good performance.
For sure.
Sounds like you're falling asleep there, Dan. It must be getting late and close to your sleep.
I was just wondering if you could hear. I mean, I just suddenly had a little crying girl next door. I don't know if you could hear her or not.
well, that's fine. Fiona's just come home and she's downstairs singing away to herself. So I'm not sure that either of them are coming through on this. But anyway, listen, Dan, it's been great to get all of that confirmation about HRV, about why it's a useful additional tool, just to give us a slightly more rounded view of whether we're recovering. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's certainly not a silver bullet that's going to double your fitness and knock an hour off your Ironman. But it is something that you can be using not just to monitor your training load, but also your general state of health, really. And for me, as a 54-year-old male, that's sort of starting to become more important to me than my athletic performance. And you'll get there as well, my friend, one day.
You're never that age already, are you? Surely not.
I am, yeah.
I always thought you were in your 30s.
Well, I was in my 30s when you knew me before. Yeah, Peter Pan. I wish I could be not Peter Pan, Benjamin Button. Do you remember the guy that got younger as he got older? But I still think I'm in my 30s. That's the key thing, like all triathletes. So anyway, Dan, it's New Zealand time. It's 9 o'clock here, so it must be 9 o'clock in the morning. It must be getting close to your bedtime. So thanks very much for sharing your experience and thoughts with us. Good luck with your Good luck with your training.
We'll see you in Kona, right?
Yeah, we'll get together and do another podcast out there.
Yeah, awesome. Maybe we can
fit in a longer talk about this pyramidal versus polarized approach to training.
Yeah, well, hopefully by then it'll if I have a good race there, it could be the way forward, hey.
Yeah, another set of papers. So, and just to confirm that paper you talked about with the prof and Phil Maffetone's athletes fit but unhealthy, and I will put a link to that on our podcast as well. And if you think that there's any of the HRV papers that you've written of the 12 that might be useful for our listeners to read, please share those with me.
You can always find me. Like, if you Google Scholar my name, Daniel Plews, all my HRV papers are listed there. And even if there's also a website called ResearchGate, and if you just sign up to that, I actually put a downloadable version of all my research papers on there, so anyone can access them. So free for all, read away.
And where can people find you, Dan, outside of the research stuff?
Twitter at the Plews One, Instagram as well. I'm being on there a little bit more readily now. I think it's at the Plews One as well. Yeah, they're the two best ways to get me, I think.
And website? Do you have your own website yet?
No, it's still plewsandprof.com. Yeah.
The Plews. So, yeah. That's what you are. The Plews is what you are on Instagram, it looks like.
Oh, there you go. Plews, yeah. The Plews on Instagram, yeah. So, so I kind of use my Instagram more for training updates of what's going on, and then in Twitter a bit more of a scientific kind of thing. So and if anyone's interested in the HRV for training, specifically the coach app, if you use the referral code Plews, you'll get 3 months free for the first subscription. So for coaches out there, I think it's a really good way of keeping check of your athletes.
Okay, that's great. Thanks for sharing that one with us, Dan. I'll use that myself when I sign up for that. I'm going to give it a try and see how we get on with monitoring everybody's HRV for the next few months.
Yeah, awesome.
Cool, right. Awesome. Dr. Dan Plews, esteemed Yorkshireman, top age group triathlete and HRV specialist. Thanks very much for joining us. Hope you enjoyed that, listeners, and we'll be back next week with another great guest. Bye for now. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.